content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with an article from the personal history section of the June 17, 2024 issue of the New Yorker magazine. Notes on a last-minute safari. We saw every animal that was in The Lion King, and then some. They were just there, like ants at a picnic, except that they were elephants and giraffes and zebras. By David Sedaris. It was a good year for Christmas parties. At one, I met a number of authors I had always admired. This could be tricky, but they were all lovely. The food was lovely, too, though I dropped a miniature barbecue sandwich on the new white shirt I was wearing and will likely never get the grease stain out. At another party, the following week, I was introduced to a curator from the Metropolitan Museum. We talked about people who throw soup and oil on beloved paintings, hoping to draw attention to climate change or poor nutrition or whatever their cause is. And then I learned that he would soon be leaving on an African safari, the sort where you carry a camera rather than a gun. "Have you been planning it for months?" I asked. "Well, actually, it all came together over the past few weeks," he told me. On the subway home, I said to Hugh in the faux pouty voice that I used to challenge extreme injustice, other couples taking a vacation when it should be us. For example, why can't we go on a safari? A month later, we were in an open-sided 4x4 vehicle surrounded by seven lions, none of which seemed to care about us. All of them were female, and I wondered if, when writing about this afterward, for surely I would, I might be taken to task for using the term lionesses. "Is it like referring to someone as a waitress or a stewardess?" I whispered to Hugh, who was seated beside me sketching. "Will people say, 'Why did you have to mention their gender in the first place? Why can't you just say lions and leave it at that?'" Well, to my mind, the gender mattered, since the females do the majority of the hunting and are therefore scarier when they're 8 feet away and can surely smell you. I looked the subject up later, when we got back to camp, and I learned that there's some debate about whether or not to refer to lionesses as she-lions. Of course, none of that debate is coming from the big cat family. What surprised me about these animals was their playfulness. The way one would sidle up to another and gently swat her, or roll over on her back with her paws in the air. We'd been stationary for 10 minutes or so, when one of the seven walked in front of our 4x4, hunched over, and defecated. I thought that, like a cat in a flower bed, she'd then cover it up. But no. The moment she rejoined the others, a jackal darted out of the tall grass, snatched the turd in his mouth, and was about to make off with it when a hyena intervened and a struggle ensued. "Over a turd," Hugh whispered. We might have stayed there for hours, happily observing, but then another 4x4 pulled up. Its passengers went nuts. "Seven lionesses!" Hugh and I looked at the new arrivals with an expression that read, "They're sort of ours," as if we personally had gathered them there. Then another 4x4 pulled up, and another after that. I don't know how many vehicles were roaming the Masai Mara that afternoon. It's a 583-square-mile nature reserve. So had there been 1,000 or other 4x4s, we likely wouldn't have seen more than a handful of them. June to October is the busiest season in Kenya, safari-wise, and this was early February. It was hot, but not humid, and there were three of us in the vehicle, me, Hugh, and our 26-year-old guide, Dalton, a Maasai tribesman who had on a moss-green shirt with the name of the place where we were staying embroidered on its right breast pocket. His pants were khaki and knee-length, worn with ankle-high suede boots. Dalton's hair was cut short. His head was almost perfectly round, and he was missing several of his bottom teeth. "What is it you would like to see?" he asked upon collecting us that first bright morning at the airstrip. "A panda," I told him. On the 90-minute drive to our camp, we saw every animal that was in The Lion King, and then some. They were just there, like ants at a picnic, except that they were elephants and giraffes. We saw zebras and leopards and wildebeests and warthogs all grazing or resting or fleeing on this grass-covered, seemingly limitless plain. "Have you seen a kill?" people in the other 4x4s, couples with camera lenses the size of the Hubble telescope, would ask. It didn't take long to realize that 7 lionesses weren't enough. They had to have blood dripping from their jaws. "On our first day, we saw a lion eating a wildebeest," I'd tell them. That was like saying you'd seen one eating a sandwich. The prize was to watch one pounce on her prey and rip its throat out. Just last month, a little after midnight, 2 lions took down a zebra right there next to your tent, the woman who checked us into our camp told us, pointing over the railing to a shaded ravine. The camp was built on the banks of the Telek River, which was swollen from recent rains, but still flowed lazily. There was no fence around the property. Wild animals came and went at their leisure, though during the day all we saw were crocodiles and mongooses. It was after dark that the action took place, so at night we had to be escorted from our tent to the common area by Maasai tribesmen carrying spears. The most dangerous animal, what Dalton called the most killingest, was the hippo. I had learned this years earlier from a nature documentary and was surprised, as they always looked so happy to me, almost like they're smiling. We saw countless hippos in Kenya. "All they want is to get into our swimming pool," the property manager, a man named Stephen, told us, "and if that happens, we will never get them out." He was giving us a tour and was leading us from the hydroponic vegetable garden, the Shamba of Goodness, it was called, to the recreation area. I looked at the man whose job it was to guard the pool we were passing. "What do hippos smell like?" I asked. Stephen thought for a moment. "Cows." There were 9 tents in all. "Are there many other guests at the moment?" I'd asked the woman who checked us in. "We have no guests here," she told me, smiling so broadly I could see her gums. "Only family." Oh, no, I thought, for doesn't a person go on safari to escape that kind of talk? Ditto Shamba of Goodness. If I know I have to get up early, I generally have a devil of a time falling asleep. The place where Hugh and I slept was a tent in the same way that a shake shack is an actual shack. The pitched ceiling was, at its highest point, 12 feet, and, not including our deck, which overlooked the river, we had a good 900 square feet of floor space, with a real floor. There was electricity and Wi-Fi, potable water, a tub, a shower, and a toilet, complimentary laundry service, outstanding food. Our outings took place early in the morning and late in the afternoon. So I'd go to bed and, knowing that we needed to meet Dalton at 6 a.m., lie awake while Hugh snored beside me. The book I'd brought along for the trip was The Andy Warhol Diaries, which didn't at all fit the location, nor did it make sense to watch, say, past seasons of Project Runway. We were in Kenya, after all, and could hear all sorts of creatures on the other side of our canvas walls roaring and moaning and carrying on. On the first night, I reached for my iPad and watched a documentary on baboons. It wasn't the kind of program that gives the animals names and talks about them in a whisper, but Denise wasn't about to give up that easily. Still, it was less interesting than I wanted it to be. The best part was when the heir to the colony, a 4-month-old male, was killed by an intruder, and his mother carried his carcass around until it was just a rag of fur. The following afternoon, we came upon a troop of baboons resting beside the river. There were at least 30 of them, many with babies on their backs. "Get out your camera," Dalton said as he turned off the 4x4's engine. I told him from the get-go that photography was not my thing. I will not be taking a single picture, I'd promised. Not even if we come upon a rhino, he asked. Not even if we see one fighting a mother grizzly, I told him. Dalton kept thinking I'd buckle, but I never did, at least not in Kenya. Later, in Tanzania, I would pull out my phone, but not for an animal. Rather, it was for a sign painted on the wall of a gas station. No smorking, it read. Evan, one of the guards at our camp, also noticed that I wasn't taking any photos. He was slight and handsome and was wearing a traditional Maasai outfit that consisted of two rectangles of plaid fabric, each a different color. On his feet were sandals made of old tires. He looked outstanding, as if he'd been dressed by Comme des Garçons. When I complimented him on his clothing, he removed the upper piece of fabric, which was worn almost like a shawl. Here, try it on, he said. I wanted to explain that in America this would be called cultural appropriation. What's that? I could imagine him asking. To be honest, I've never understood it myself. I think it's when you make a taco with, like, blue cheese on it, was the best I would have been able to come up with. Everyone else is photographing all the time, Evan said, taking back the piece of fabric and sounding, if not hurt, then at least a little underappreciated. So why not you? I jot things down instead, I told him, pulling my notebook from my pocket and showing it to him. For instance, earlier today I wrote, I looked at a page and groaned. It was as if a person with only two fingers, one on each hand, had written it, while in a bumper car. I never saw a paved road in the Maasai Mara. A few were wide enough for two vehicles, but were still as rocky and hard to navigate as the barely discernible, often flooded paths we were frequently found ourselves on. My big fear before going on safari was that I wouldn't be able to exercise. We weren't allowed to venture on foot beyond the confines of our camp. So I worried that in order to meet my daily Apple Watch minimum of 10,000 steps, roughly 4.5 miles, I'd have to walk back and forth across our deck for hours on end. I had 2.5 miles under my belt the morning that Dalton met us at the airstrip, and by the time we reached our camp, I'd miraculously logged twice that many. It seemed my watch mistook the bumpiness of the road and the jostling it gave rise to for walking. This was great for my step count, but was awful for writing. It was only when we stopped that I could record anything legible. That said, my notes weren't always as illuminating as I'd expected them to be. What does alt mean? I asked Hugh over dinner one night. He looked down at the page. It's not alt, he said. It's A period L period T period. Then I remembered. We'd been out early that morning, observing a short parade of ostriches. It was misty, and I pointed to a vague shape on the horizon. What's that? I asked Dalton. He followed my finger and told me it was likely an ALT. Animal-looking thing, he explained. Another of my notes simply read, wow. But I knew right off what it referred to, the highlight of our trip. We had driven up alongside a herd of 8 elephants, 3 of them babies. Their size was impressive, but I was prepared for that. What surprised me, and was so magnificent, was the sound of the tall grass they were eating being torn from the ground with their trunks. Dalton had turned the engine off, so that was all we could hear. Close your eyes, I said to Hugh, as I closed my own as well. If I were to manufacture a perfume, it would smell the way that grass being ripped from the ground by elephants sounds, simultaneously soothing and astonishing, and simply everyone would have to have it. The problem is that it wouldn't go with any of the perfume names I've come up with over the years, the best being obsequious. The 8 elephants were on our last day in Kenya. The following morning, we flew to Tanzania, not for more safari, but to stay in a resort on the island of Zanzibar. The only animals I saw during our time there were lizards, some nearly a foot long, and snails the size of Hugh's fist. The beach was pretty, sand as white as sugar, palm trees. The property was guarded by men with clubs tucked under their belts, and the moment you left it, walking, say, the 20 feet from your lounge chair to the water's edge, you were set upon by people trying to sell you things. A hard-boiled egg from a bucket, a seashell, cashews, a ride on a boat, a painting of a leopard, a T-shirt with Hakuna Matata printed on it. "My friend!" someone would call, extending a closed fist and wanting you to tap it with one of your own, even while you were in the sea. This is why I have never been to Bali or Mauritius or any of those other places people go to get some sun in the winter. The water in Zanzibar was warm and such an arresting shade of turquoise that it seemed to have been dyed. But the income gap between the people who stayed at the resort and the people who actually lived on the island was so wide you couldn't really see anything else. Plus, the hotel staff said Hakuna Matata, which means no worries in Swahili, incessantly. "Could I maybe have some more coffee?" "Hakuna Matata." "I'm not feeling terribly well." "Hakuna Matata." "God, that's a big snail." "Hakuna Matata." It got to the point where you didn't dare say anything just because you didn't want to hear Hakuna Matata again. There were no price tags on anything. If you were to ask how much a sack of peppercorns was and the answer started with, "For you, I am going to offer a special deal," you knew you'd be overpaying. Everyone we came across was seemingly on the make. And who could blame them, really? "How much for a ride to Stonetown and back?" Hugh and I asked a taxi driver one swampy afternoon. He quoted us a price, but when we got there he claimed, "I didn't say 150,000 shillings, the equivalent of nearly $60. I said 200,000, which simply wasn't true. In the grand scheme of things, it wasn't an enormous amount, a difference of $20, which I was going to give him anyway as a tip. But when you capped it off with Hakuna Matata, I felt like crying. We could have ended our vacation in Kenya. It was me who wanted to add Tanzania, and mainly so that I could put it on my list of countries I have traveled to. The only thing I knew before arriving was that it's not safe to be an albino there. Many people consider them to be evil, yet place great value on their organs and other body parts, their hands and hearts, entire legs. It's easier to harvest them from children, so kids are at a higher risk of being abducted and dismembered. Their parts are sold to witch doctors, who use them to create amulets and potions one might employ while searching for precious metals, say, or to improve one's luck in regard to fishing. It sounds absolutely insane. How could anyone possibly be so gullible, you wonder? Then you think of all the Americans, some may be your neighbors, your co-workers, your wife or your uncle, who genuinely believe that JFK Jr. did not die in a plane crash, but is alive and well and working in cahoots with Donald Trump to stop the Clintons from drinking the blood of babies. And you're like, "The leg of a butchered child might help me find gold." Okay, I guess I've heard crazier things. The world can be a savage place, but that's not the lesson you want to carry home with you. Yes, we humans are cruel and often dangerous, but there's still nature, and before it's too late, we need to appreciate it. Of course, not everyone can hang out with elephants, but look at that bird perched on your feeder, and that squirrel chasing the bird away from said feeder. Look at the rats scuttering before you on a New York street, at the spider that somehow got trapped in your elevator. We're all on a safari of one kind or another. It's just that some of us aren't returning with two brilliant rectangles of Maasai plaid fabric and a bacterial infection. Next, from the book section of the June 24th, 2024 issue of The New Yorker, how the philosopher Charles Taylor would heal the ills of modernity. Enlightenment liberalism fragmented the world by neglecting the social nature of the self, Taylor contends. But the Romantics can tell us how to restore a shared sense of meaning and purpose, by Adam Gopnik. Lyric poets and mathematicians, by general agreement, do their best work young, while composers and conductors are evergreen, doing their best work, or more work of the same kind, as they age. Philosophers seem to be a more mixed bag. Some shine early, and some, like Wittgenstein, have distinct chapters of youth and middle age. Bertrand Russell went on tirelessly until he was almost 100. Yet, surely few will surpass the record of the Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor, who is back at 92 with what may be the most ambitious work ever written by a major thinker at such an advanced age. The new book, Cosmic Connections, Poetry in the Age of Disenchantment, published by Belknap. Although ostensibly a study of romantic poetry and music, is about nothing less than modern life and its discontents and how we might transcend them. A hard thinker to pigeonhole, Taylor has long been a mainstay of Canada's social democratic left. He helped found the New Democratic Party, running for office several times in Quebec, though losing, inevitably, to the Liberal Party and the charismatic Pierre Trudeau. He's also a Catholic and a singularly eloquent critic of individualism and secularism, those two pillars of modern liberalism. He worries about the modern conception of the self, what is he has called the punctual self, which he takes to be rooted in Enlightenment thought, and about the primacy it accords to autonomy, reason, and individual rights. By wresting our identities away from a sense of community and common purpose, the new atomist instrumental model was, he thinks, bound to produce our familiar modern alienation. We became estranged from a sense of belonging and meaning. We experienced the attenuation of the citizen participation politics we need. We wanted to be alone, and now we are. With this analysis, critical of the foundations of liberalism, without betraying liberal values, Taylor manages to be at once precise and prophetic. He may be the most well-regarded philosopher in the English-speaking world, having snatched most of the big prizes, including the million-dollar Berggruen Prize in 2016. There are now books about his books, study guides, and websites dedicated to indexing his oeuvre. When I was a kid, growing up in Montreal around McGill University, where Taylor taught for more than three decades, he was a significant, if troubling, presence. Not personally troubling, quite the opposite. He was an amiable faculty friend, but troubling because in my own science worshiping, what the other side would have called positivist, faculty family, Taylor's rehabilitation of Hegel seemed almost sinister. Of such matters are quarrels made in Barchester. Nonetheless, at some point I began to read Taylor, first with the fascination of the forbidden, and then with ever-increasing pleasure. Though Taylor was defending a German idealist tradition that a more empirical-minded tradition had denounced as mere verbiage and wind, he had spent a formative period in the precincts of ordinary language philosophy at Oxford, where he was mentored by Isaiah Berlin. He spoke the plainer dialects of Anglo-American philosophy. The phone calls were coming from inside the house. Indeed, he felt that Berlin had abandoned philosophy for the history of ideas because the moral philosophy of his day was too parched to capture the complexities Berlin cared about. As a social and political theorist, Taylor emphasized the primacy of shared experience. The idea that identity resides within communities rather than inside brains, without succumbing to nostalgia for some lost organic society. What matters most in life to actual people, he has argued, is not the standard liberal question, who am I, but the richer humanist question, where am I going? In expansive volumes such as Sources of the Self and A Secular Age, he has stalked, like a soft-footed cat, a naturalist view of humanity, which assimilates our minds and morals to a purely materialist and empirical program of study. We are not atoms in a mindless universe, he argues, but agents in a metaphysically alert one, embodied and embedded in meanings we jointly create. Art is not an accessory to pleasure, but the means of our connection to the cosmos. Taylor's new book is formidably chewy, with page after page featuring passages of Hölderlin and Novalis and Rilke, offered both in the original German and in translation. Long analyses of T.S. Eliot and Milos arrive too. But though Taylor's subjects are often severely abstract, his sentences are lucid, even charmingly direct, and his purpose is plain. We once lived in an enchanted universe of agreed upon meaning and common purpose, where we looked at the night sky and felt that each object was shaped with significance by a God-given order. Now we live in the modern world the Enlightenment produced, one of fragmented belief and broken promise purposes, where no God superintends the cosmos. Common agreement on meaning is no longer possible, and all you can do with the moon is measure it. I admire the moon as a moon, just a moon, Lorenz Hart sighed, with memorable modernity adding, significantly, nobody's heart belongs to me today. Enlightened, we are alone. Romantic poetry, the poetry of Shelley and Keats in English, of Novalis and Hölderlin in German, first diagnosed this fracture, the argument goes, and offered a way to heal it. Where neoclassical poets like Alexander Pope appealed to an ordered world with clear meanings and a hierarchy of kinds, the Romantics recognized that this was no longer credible. The enchanted world had been replaced by the modern world. We could hardly go back toward ignorance. Goethe, one of Taylor's heroes, participated in the modern world as a scientist, but we had to find a way to re-enchant it. The best way to heal the wound is through poetry and music, of the sort that doesn't offer propositions, but casts spells and enacts rituals. The arts are not subsidiary places of secondary sensations, but the primary place where we go to recall feelings of wholeness, of harmony, not just with nature. The craggy peaks the Romantics loved and the Italian lakes they lingered by, but with existence itself. Poetry and music do this by escaping the constraints of intellect, by going at things atmospherically rather than argumentatively. They convey a sublime atmosphere of sound, ineffable intimations of immortality, and so the apprehension of a cosmic connection. Taylor reproduces lines from Wordsworth's Tintern Abbey, and the round ocean and the living air, and the blue sky and in the mind of man, a motion and a spirit that impels all thinking things, all objects of thought, and tells us to let oneself be carried by this passage is to experience a strong sense of connection, far from clearly defined but deeply felt, a connection not static but which flows through us and our world. Keats's Ode to a Nightingale is similarly effervescent in diction, similarly ethereal in effect. The lines, "Oh, for a beaker full of the warm south, full of the true, the blushful hippocrene, with beaded bubbles winking at the brim and purple-stained mouth," cast a spell as much as they describe a feeling. Taylor writes, "The rhythmic flow between the features as recounted in the poem somehow encounters, meets, connects up with the flow between the features as we live it." Classical art, he argues, moves us by convincing us. Romantic art convinces us by moving us. Taylor is challenging the belief that science provides objective truth and art merely subjective feeling, that art produces sensations and what you make of the sensations is all up to you. He insists that there is intrinsic, grounded human value in the experience of art. At one point, he constructs a table in which he contrasts things toward which our attitudes are subjective with things that have hard biological significance. I may prefer vanilla ice cream to strawberry, but I must have air to breathe. Is listening to Beethoven, he asks, more like preferring vanilla ice cream or more like needing to breathe? Or does it, as Taylor is convinced, belong to the realm of ethical elevation? Perhaps hearing late Beethoven is more like seeing that viral video of a small Chinese boy meticulously cooking a meal of egg-fried rice for his still smaller sibling than it is like the experience of eating the fried rice. Strong ethical insights are grounded in what I called felt intuition, Taylor writes. Someone couldn't be said to have a moral conviction about universal human rights, for instance, if she wasn't prone on the appropriate occasions to experience them, to feel them as inspiring, hearing the choral movement of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, and their flagrant violation as appalling. We are convinced because we are moved. The reasoning may seem circular. I know it's inspiring because it feels inspiring. But his point is that what great modern poetry does is to encircle us with inspiring feelings. Art isn't absolute, but it isn't at all arbitrary. Taylor escapes from the divide between subjectivity and objectivity through a concept he calls the interspace. Not the inner space where I perceive and enjoy, but some resonant atmosphere that exists between me and the world. The sound of the cello in a Schubert trio isn't entirely in the cello, where the sound begins, or entirely between my listening ears, where the experience of structural sound as music happens, but somewhere between the two, where the creation of meaning takes place. The interspace is the phenomenal field of the arts. When we listen to sublime music, then, our experience is not of pleasure, but of an overwhelming feeling of encountering and exploring some truth. The music sculpts us. We sculpt the music. And to reduce this to mood misses the cosmic connection that the experience proposes and quite often provides. All of this is attractive, directed at some unnamed but quite easily imagined contemporary grad grind who thinks that poetry is mere decor and music mere entertainment. In a footnote, Taylor cites Steven Pinker's provocation that music is auditory cheesecake, and who scoffs at the conviction of aesthetes and humanists that music and art contain a kind of knowledge. Most readers will respond to Taylor's contagious excitement in the presence of Wordsworth and Rilke and Beethoven. His are ideas that one assents to enthusiastically, even while realizing that it would be hard to defend them to someone less inclined to assent. Indeed, one recalls the spiral of puzzled questions that apostles of the arts regularly encounter from the science-minded, who insist that when we invoke the ethical allure of music, we're just saying we really like those fuzzy feelings. If Taylor's experiential enthusiasms sometimes do not seem too far away from the lyrics to Misty, "Walk my way and a thousand violins begin to play," well, being misty about something is a precondition of transcendence, even if it's only that old black magic called love. And so the interspace between Taylor and the art-infatuated reader is likely to be one of enthusiastic assent. Yes, it does feel like that. Yes, it is a big experience. Yes, I feel the cosmos. When I browse through Spotify, passing from Ray Charles to the obscurer singers of the Stax Volt catalog, each stop along the way offers some experience of common space, which is not just diverting, but deeply reassuring. Yes, there is a meaning in the mess. Yes, the space says yes. The last 50 pages of Cosmic Connections pivot decisively from the intricacies of poetic imagination to the specifics of contemporary American and Canadian, and secondarily, European politics, toward the social interspace, so to speak. A long section turns to the questions of white supremacy, civil rights, national identity, and the rise of Trumpist populism, and so on. A successful self-governing republic, Taylor believes, requires a community of shared purpose and a common space of deliberation. Antagonistic groups must go beyond the narrow aspiration of winning a contest against adversaries and come to one another with a sense of mutual recognition and regard. And the people best able to make this case, in Taylor's view, are people who are deeply rooted in their spiritual sources, often religious. These are people who, at least culturally, have retained a sense of the sacred. Overcoming discrimination becomes not just an abstract advance in justice or an instrumental strategy for minimizing conflict, but a source of deep fulfillment. Taylor is a believer in the importance of place. One does not provincialize his work by situating it within the province it comes from. Born in Montreal, Taylor was shaped by the peculiar social fabric of Quebec. The communal connection among Québécois remains unusually strong. It's reinforced by linguistic isolation, which outside Montreal often produces an inward-turning monolingual culture, and in Montreal, an outward-turning bilingual one. The Catholic Church has collapsed as a living force, but it provides a cultural scaffolding in which much else still takes place. The holiday celebrating the now secularized cause of Quebec nationalism is a religious one, June 24th, Saint John Baptiste Day. Quebec is openly cosmopolitan in effect and narrowly communal in arrangement, and for the most part, the two forces contest peaceably. Taylor is inclined by his experience to think that communal and the cosmopolitan can coexist. You can belong to a tribe and still belong to the people. The politics of recognition that Taylor has recommended gives weight accordingly to the demands that communities, ethnic, religious, or otherwise, make on the state. Given Taylor's emphasis on the embodied dimensions of social meaning, it seems significant that he was reared in a bicultural household. His mother was a Francophone Catholic, and his father an Anglophone Protestant. McGill is a great English-speaking university in the midst of a French-speaking city, and though its autonomy and financing is threatened from time to time by the provincial government, it has survived through even the most extreme independence-minded administrations. Montreal is a very good place to nourish the belief that communities can supply meaning without fomenting mayhem. The link Taylor wants to make between his readings of poetry and his civic lessons has affinities to the proposals made by a number of writers, many of them Catholic, significantly, throughout the modern period. The meticulous remaking of ritual, which you find in Chesterton and Tolkien alike, the love of the local, the revaluing of ceremony and communal spirit as things essential in themselves rather than leftovers from a barbaric past. The wrong kind of politics, Taylor implies, arises from the loss of a cosmic connection which the Romantics first sensed and which now is part of the unhappy inheritance of our civilization. Alienated and disconnected, the Trump voter, the Brexiteer, the Le Pen supporter turns to theatricalized reassurance of fascist-style unity, predicated on the demonization of the nearby other. Taylor celebrates Pope Francis's encyclicals on extended families with their sense of the common good, and those native religions which get their sense of the sacred from a specific place of dwelling. He turns again to the interspace, now lofted to become not only the theater of reception and communication between artist and audience, but also the implicit space of political community. The turn from poetry to politics is certainly seductive, but is it persuasive? Certain objections rise even in the mind of the reader stirred by these kind of accounts. First, and simplest, should we be so enchanted by enchantment? Taylor treats the change from the enchanted world to the post-Enlightenment naturalistic world as a change from one climate of opinion to another, rather than as any kind of progress. But progress does seem to be the right word for it. Life in the enchanted world was poorer, briefer, uglier, and more brutal. The opposition of the enchanted and the disenchanted, one world lacking in technological power but rich in communal spirit, the other rich in machines but poor in soul, is tilted toward the past. To put it plainly, the disenchanted universe is one where, increasingly, human suffering is resolved by vaccination and effective drugs, not by bleeding and cupping. Taylor's response would be to point out that if we have to look past leprosy and death in childbirth in chronicling the enchanted, we also have to look past Treblinka, the killing field, wounded knee, and more in chronicling the disenchanted. Yet such a rejounder is corrosive of the neat division between the two worlds he makes. Though he never says it directly, the atmospherics of Taylor's book suggest that great music is an agent of moral growth. So you can wonder what it would be like if we had a civilization where romantic music was the soundtrack of the people, and where even military victories and defeats were celebrated through the allure of symphonic sound. In fact, such a society existed in the Third Reich of the 1940s. Loving Schubert and Beethoven, it seems, gets you nowhere at all ethically. And then the question arises of whether the alteration between the enchanted and the enlightened is really the historical one proposed by Taylor's Hegelian model, with its emphasis on an unfolding one-way plot, or rather a permanent tension in all literate times. Shakespeare's language, as Taylor hints at various moments, is structured by a pull between inherited magic and Renaissance cynicism. Ted Hughes made the point that Shakespeare stood balanced on a knife's edge between myth and measurement, between an old fairy tale world and a new empirical one. There's visionary language in the sonnets that seems to say almost more than we can understand. The prophetic soul of the wide world dreaming on things to come. An acerbic worldliness right next door. My mistress' eyes are nothing like the sun. Enchanted and enlightened sensibilities rise throughout history and seem two points in the cycle of human possibility, more than two moments in a fixed historical sequence. A third point relates to Taylor's particular appetite for poetry. He likes the sides of Keats and Wordsworth that are ineffable, symbolic, atmospheric, and mystically resonant. But this taste can lead him, so to speak, to miss the ice cubes in the tumbler while seeking the iceberg in the ocean. Romantic poetry gets some of its meaning by overwhelming us, but it also gets meaning by making a disputable case. There's a lot of atmosphere in romantic poetry, but also a lot of argument. Shelley was obsessed with the scientific findings of his day, and they showed up in his verse. Keats's claim that beauty is truth, truth beauty, is contestable on its own terms, and the subsequent claim that this is all we need to know puts one in mind of the philosopher's favorite T-shirt. Surely not everybody was kung fu fighting. One hates to pit one great Polish poet against one another, but Taylor's book might have benefited by having a little more Szymborska and little less Milos, since she gets an effect quite as romantic as her counterparts simply by inventorying the actual world of peeled onions and doctor's offices. Humanistic inquiry may not be susceptible to strict empirical measurement or evolutionary explanation, but it seems rational, forcing us to argue out our tastes and values. To treat art as a question of personal taste is, as Taylor thinks, reductive, but it's also impractical. It is to forget that almost all we ever do is argue about taste. And the good arguments often ask how art corresponds to our experience or shines light on our values. Taylor extols the communities of meaning that are drawn together by the interspace of enchantment. Yet, as he would be the first to acknowledge, such communities are, first of all, communities of practice. We learn to listen, just as we learn to read. Learning to love Beethoven's music is first to love the sound, then to find it achingly long-winded, then to sustain concentration, then to find the concentration rewarded by new understanding, only to return to the pleasure of the sound. The interspace is an arena of shared education as much as of solitary epiphany. Ritual without reason has led modernity in many wrong directions. Practical communities are as valuable as poetic communities. The experiences Taylor evokes of being overwhelmed by aesthetic responses, scarcely distinguishable from ethical elevation, are ones we encounter daily. Exploring a stranger's playlist of Chuck Berry and his precursors, reading a newly sent poem, or seeing an Instagram story of children in a distant land sharing a meal. The interspace is enchanted mainly in its normalcy. Perhaps connecting with the cosmos is not as hard as philosophers sometimes imagine. It's where we live. Next, from the June 17th, 2024 issue of The New Yorker, a new book about plant intelligence highlights the messiness of scientific change. In The Light Eaters by Zoe Schlanger, the field of botany itself functions as a character, one in the process of undergoing a potentially radical transformation. By Rachel Reiteder. During the 1970s and 80s, a researcher at the University of Washington started noticing something strange in his college's experimental forest. For years, a blight of caterpillars had been munching the trees to death. Then, suddenly, the caterpillars themselves started dying off. The forest was able to recover, but what happened to the caterpillars? The researcher, David Rhodes, who had a background in chemistry and zoology, found that the trees in the forest had changed the chemistry of their leaves to the detriment of the caterpillars. Even more surprising, trees that had been nibbled by caterpillars weren't the only ones that had changed their chemistry. Some were changing their leaves before the caterpillars reached them, as if they'd received a warning. A shocking possibility presented itself. The trees were signaling to one another. Zoe Schlanger recounts Rhodes' story in her new book, The Light Eaters, how the unseen world of plant intelligence offers a new understanding of life on Earth. In a research paper that Rhodes published on his findings in the Journal of the American Chemical Society series, Plant Resistance to Insects, he pointed out that the trees were too far apart to be communicating through their roots. This suggested a possibility so novel that Rhodes couldn't resist an exclamation point in his otherwise cautious positive. The trees seemed to be using airborne pheromonal substances. That paper, Schlanger writes, would change everything, and in a cruel twist, it would end his career, because back then, no one believed him. The contemporary world of botany that Schlanger explores in The Light Eaters is still divided over the matter of how plants sense the world and whether they can be said to communicate. But in the past 20 years, the idea that plants communicate has gained broader acceptance. Research in recent decades has shown garden variety lima beans protecting themselves by synthesizing and releasing chemicals to summon the predators of the insects that eat them. Lab-grown pea shoots navigating mazes and responding to the sound of running water, and a chameleonic vine in the jungles of Chile mimicking the shape and color of nearby plants by a mechanism that's not yet understood. Schlanger acknowledges that some of the research yields as many questions as answers. It's not clear how the vine gathers information about surrounding plants to perform its mimicry, or what exactly that ability says about plants' ability to sense the world around them. And not all of the research is equally sound. The pea shoot study, for example, performed in 2016 by the ecologist Monica Gagliano, who has written about communicating with plants while taking ayahuasca, is particularly controversial, and a replication effort was not successful. But an increasing number of scientists has begun to ask the question that animates her book, Are Plants Intelligent? Schlanger's own introduction to the notion that plants might be able to exhibit behavior at all came when she learned that male ferns release sperm that swim in rainwater. Emerging research indicated that they emit a hormone to sabotage other nearby fern sperm in order to outcompete them. It's already clear that plants have amazing biological capabilities. They respond to light and react in sophisticated ways to seasonal changes, waiting for the right combination of warmth and water to grow or flower. Plants have also been shown to respond to sound. The beach evening primrose, a small yellow flower, makes its nectar sweeter when played a recording of a flying honeybee. A recurrent theme of Schlanger's book is the challenge of categorizing such abilities in comparison with our own. Primroses may respond to sound, but that doesn't mean that they hear the way that we do. As Schlanger writes, they have a version of earless hearing. Sound to them is pure vibration. A pattern emerges in her survey of the field. The scientist Schlanger visits shows her the plant versions of the building blocks of intelligence, sensation, communication, decision-making. Rhodes wasn't able to convince the field that the trees were sending one another caterpillar warnings, but not long after his paper, another study, this one in the controlled confines of a laboratory, had found that maple saplings changed their leaf composition when neighboring trees' leaves were torn. In a lab in Wisconsin, Schlanger pinches the leaf of an Arabidopsis plant and sees its veins light up under a microscope in a bioluminescent ripple of a wave of sensation. It seems to Schlanger that by pinching the lab plant, she will cause it pain and be partaking in a vegetal version of the Milgram shock experiment. One of the scientists running the experiment, Simon Gilroy, offers a nuanced description of the system. The ripple looks similar to an animal's nervous system, but is actually a set of conduits of cells that could allow propagation of an electrical change that a plant uses for information. Plants don't have brains. They don't have neurons. But they might have structures that function similarly. Are plants intelligent? It doesn't just depend on whom you ask, but what you mean by the term. Schlanger proposes several ways of describing intelligence, all of which apply to both humans and plants. The ability to communicate, the transmission of information via electrochemistry, the ability to respond to the threats and opportunities that the world presents. By design, these definitions stretch the definition of intelligence beyond what we're used to. For Schlanger, that's part of the appeal. A key lesson of studying plant intelligence, she suggests, referencing Michael Pollan, is that perhaps we should rethink our own. In the course of the book, Schlanger changes from a curious observer to a party in the debate. She becomes convinced not only that plants are intelligent, but that recognizing them as such alters the way we see the world. She writes about a modern affliction that botanists often call plant blindness, seeing plants as wallpaper instead of as fellow beings. Schlanger also asks whether humanity would benefit from a heightened appreciation of plants and expansion of our ethical consideration to include them. Schlanger's not suggesting that people forego eating fruits and vegetables, but she imagines a fundamental shift in our relationship to nature. She makes the gesture gently in a final chapter that moves breezily through the philosophy of consciousness and the burgeoning movement to ascribe personhood to some parts of ecosystems. But what she's pointing to is something radical. So much of the way that society is organized depends on the belief that humans are supreme among organisms. And a key reason for that supremacy is the idea that we are uniquely intelligent. To describe plant behavior using the lens of intelligence creates a category crisis, destabilizing not just how we see the green things in the world, but also our place in the hierarchy of beings and maybe the notion of that hierarchy itself. I read the book mostly in my small New York City garden during spring, with plenty of plants in the background. A year of coaxing tulips and lettuce out of the ground had given me a healthy respect for plants, but I saw them mostly as the raw material in my personal project. I chose which color flower went where. I dutifully surrounded the tomatoes with marigolds to ward off pests and basil to help improve their flavor. But under Schlanger's influence, I started taking notice of the ways that they were active. Pea shoots waved their tiny tendrils around until they found purchase and grasped a stake. The sharp fragrances of mint and rosemary leaves were meant to repel insects. I didn't start to see the plants in my garden as conscious exactly, but I was struck by the sophistication of what they could do. I found myself returning often to the epigraph of Schlanger's book, a quote from an ethnobotanist that could stand as a pithy reply to the question of whether plants are intelligent. They can eat light. Isn't that enough? And now, from the June 24th, 2024 New Yorker, Sweet for Voices by Joyce Carol Oates. Solitary. If there is no one to hear the cry, is there a cry that there is no one? Poem for the poet's birthday. After Novocaine, pain returns in small surges. You might mistake for the life it has replaced. Bill, you've always known the composing of a poem is removing tooth from bone deep-rooted in the bloody jaw, no matter with what mercy and precision. A year of tears. A year of tears and tears in the sky we called the road to nowhere. And now, the road to the bright shore we hate for rousing hope where there should be none. We've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it, and we'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.